This is Jessica, and you're listening to the Asian Madness Podcast. Qatar, officially known as the State of Qatar, is a small Middle Eastern country located on the northeastern coast of the Arabian Peninsula. Most of Qatar borders the Persian Gulf, and to the south of Qatar you will find Saudi Arabia, the only country that shares a border with Qatar. The second closest country to Qatar would be Bahrain, which is an island to the northwest of Qatar. Qatar is a tiny country to begin with, about 11,500 square kilometers, or about 4,500 square miles, about the same size as the state of Connecticut, and about one-third the size of Taiwan. It is, however, about 16 times larger than Singapore, just to paint a picture. The capital city is Doha, located on the central eastern coast. As of recent, the population sits at around 3 million, and 80% of the population reside in the city of Doha. Qatar is not big to begin with, but most of the country is actually desert land. The official language is Arabic. And as for the population's ethnicity, only about 10% of the actual population are known as Qatari. In other words, most people living in Qatar are considered foreigners, which includes what we call expats and migrant workers. The official religion is Islam, with about 65% of the population identifying as Muslim, and the rest include Hinduism, Christianity, and others. Qatar currently has the fourth highest GDP per capita in the world, and it is the richest country in the Middle East, mainly due to its oil and natural gas industry. Unfortunately, it is also the largest contributor to carbon emissions, per capita, of course. Moving on to some history and background regarding Qatar. The name Qatar is believed to have come from the early inhabitants and settlement on the peninsula, referred to as the Qatharay. It eventually evolved into Qatara, so on and so forth, and it became Qatar. The first signs of humans in the area known as Qatar goes back about 50,000 years, around the Stone Age. Artifacts from the Ubaid period have been found along the coast, including the most important settlement of Al-Dasa. There is also evidence showing that the Qatar settlers had traded with the Kassite Babylonians around the year 2000 BCE. Moving forward to the early CE years, the area surrounding the Persian Gulf was under the Sasanian Empire's control, the last empire from ancient Iran. Many countries under the empire at the time were introduced to and affected by Christianity, but all that changed around 628 CE when a Muslim envoy was sent to the Arabic countries. They managed to convince the Arab settlements in the region to forget about Christianity and to accept Islam instead. Their influence grew, and once Islam took over for good, it meant that the Sasanian Empire was also over for good. During the short-lived Islamic Umayyad period, Qatar was mostly known for horse and camel breeding. Since a huge part of Qatar is covered in flat desert land, having an abundance of camels is a good thing. As time went on, the pearl industry in Qatar took off as well, and during the Abbasid Empire, which lasted until the mid-1200s, it became a major hub for pearl trading. Qatar being mostly surrounded by water also meant that trading with other countries was more accessible, and trading partners included China, India, and West Africa. Before oil and natural gas was a thing, Qatar became rich from pearls and trading, also mastering weaving and innovation of various day-to-day tools. With their wealth, they were able to build better quality buildings and mosques. In the meantime, kingdoms and empires came and went, as history often goes, but all of them were Muslim and Arabic. An outside disruption came, though, in the early 1500s, and that would be the Portuguese. The Portuguese came over by ship, took over Eastern Arabia, as in Bahrain and Qatar around the year 1521. They mainly focused on making their conquered lands a major commercial hub, specializing in precious items like pearls, gold, silver, and anything of value. The Ottoman Empire at the time was also fighting to control parts of the region, and they did manage to take over some areas. It's nothing new where a bigger or more powerful country or empire forced their way in just to take their goods and profit from that. But this Portuguese conqueror did not last too long, and in 1602, less than a century later, they would be forced out of the region. The Ottoman Empire was also forced out a little later, in the year 1670. Now came the era of Bani Khalid, also known as an Arab tribal confederation. Their reign of the land lasted till the late 1700s, when the House of Khalifa, the ruling power of Bahrain, took over Qatar as well as Bahrain. As you can see, Qatar and Bahrain seem to share a lot of their history, as they are not only close in distance, they are both rather small and located on the Persian Gulf. But Qatar did not seem to enjoy being ruled by the House of Khalifa, and the Qatari-Bahraini War broke out in 1867. This war ended when the British arrived to mediate, as the war supposedly violated the maritime truce. Once the war was over, Britain determined that the Al Thani family, or the House of Thani, would be the ruler of Qatar under Mohammed bin Thani. The House of Thani, despite being named as the Qatari ruler, ended up submitting to the Ottoman Empire in 1871. The Al Thani were not really pleased with this change. Sure, they seemed to be pretty self-sufficient and had minimal intervention from the Ottoman Empire. But the Ottoman Empire did, at one or several points in time, attempt to replace Al Thani. Mohammed bin Thani, known as the first official ruler of the Qatari Peninsula, had a son, Jassim bin Mohammed, who succeeded him in 1878. He was very opposed to the Ottoman Empire's proposed changes, and because of his outright opposing views, he declared that he's done. He quits. He was no longer in charge. So, he stopped paying taxes. The Ottoman Empire ended up sending people to find him, and he thus fled Doha with a few of his tribe people. In retaliation, the Ottoman Empire imprisoned many of his relatives and friends, urging him to give himself up. He refused, and thus started the Battle of Wajba. Jassim won this battle, forcing the Ottoman troops to back off, release his people, and allow him a safe return home. Jassim is also labeled as the founder of the state of Qatar. Even though his win did not free them from the Ottoman Empire, it did impact their agreement and would begin the process of Qatar's semi-independence. Moving on to the early 1900s, the Ottoman Empire finally decided that, okay, they're going to leave Qatar alone. But bad timing. World War I broke out, and then the ruler of Qatar, Abdullah bin Jassim Al Thani, was known to be quite aligned with the British. He ended up signing the Anglo-Qatari Treaty with the British, making Qatar an official protectorate of Britain. The British were given a lot of free rein in Qatar, and in the treaty, they were basically seen as complete equals in Qatar. This includes, quote, allowing British nationals to compete with local inhabitants in the pearl trade, mandating the appointment of a British political resident in Qatar, and allowing Britain to establish a post and a telegraph office in the country, unquote. Quite generous of Abdullah bin Jassim. But of course, they also look for something in return. The British vaguely agreed to provide protection to Qatar in case other nations attempted to display aggression or invade them. World War I ended, and now people had more time to focus on their internal matters. It was right before the start of World War II when oil reserves were discovered in Qatar. Unfortunately for the British, though, the Second World War had started, so the oil thing had to wait. Not like the oil fields were going to walk out anyway. Abdullah bin Jassim had promised the British as well that they would not form any relationship with any other nations without pre-approval from Britain. So the British went off to fight the Axis powers. Once World War II was over, Britain finally had the time now to focus on the oil business in Qatar. The exports began in 1949, and this, of course, made Qatar rich. With their newfound oil wealth, Qatar had a pretty big makeover, focusing on expansion and modernization. Finally, in 1968, Britain announced that they had plans to withdraw from the Persian Gulf, but it wouldn't be this instant. It would take about 3 years for them to finalize and leave them be. Aside from Qatar, there were various other confederates in the region that had signed a protectorate treaty with Britain. In 1971, Qatar and Bahrain rejected talks to join with the others, and thus the United Arab Emirates was formed, while Bahrain and Qatar became independent one after the other in August and September of 1971. Fast forward to something big, the Gulf War. In short, Iraq owed Kuwait money due to the Iran-Iraq War, and add in some dispute over oil fields, Iraq ended up invading and taking over Kuwait on August 2, 1990. Many other nations joined to push back on Iraq, including the United States, United Kingdom, and Saudi Arabia. Although Qatar was probably not up for any actual fighting, they did allow the Canadians and American troops to use their air bases and territories if need be. Kuwait was taken back, and Iraq was ultimately unable to combat everyone else, pushing their way into their country. As mentioned earlier, Qatar's economic growth has been extremely fast, mainly thanks to natural gas and oil fields. The country is known to be very modern despite being a traditional society. For one thing, sexual intercourse outside of marriage is illegal. Alcohol is regulated with a quote-unquote sin tax, which makes it extra expensive. And there's a conservative dress code in many areas, including Doha. Qatar received the right to host the 2022 FIFA World Cup, and this made them the third country in Asia to host FIFA and the first Arab/Muslim country to host. Politics-wise, the Al Thani, or the House of Thani, are still the ruling family of Qatar. As you can see, Qatar is a monarchy and quite authoritarian. Their laws also prohibit the, quote, establishment of political bodies or trade unions, unquote. Despite Qatar being a small country, I think it kind of gives off Singapore vibes, but Middle East style. They're both small, they're both quite rich, both are very safe countries, both have their own very famous and award-winning international airline, and both countries have amazing airports. So maybe some of you now have the travel itch to go see Qatar, as it is said to be extremely safe, even for solo women travelers. Hope that was good information, and now let's get on to our case. Today's topic was not a request, but more of something I found as I was trying to look into different parts of Asia. There's no shortage of cases from East Asia or even Southeast Asia, but let's face it, we rarely get to venture out to the Middle East. Unless you have roots from that area, I feel like there's so much of it that is unknown to everyone else. It's definitely fascinating, so here we are, diving into Qatar. Many people who have moved from America or Europe to places like Oman, the Emirates, or Qatar have mentioned how safe they feel. Because of the rigid laws in these countries and constant surveillance everywhere, even women feel safe going out at night, like at 3 or 4 in the morning. But sometimes, things can still go wrong. Let's use Japan as an example. Japan has been blowing up everywhere on social media in recent years, making it a hotspot for not just couples and families, but also solo travelers. Sure, it's a relatively safe country, but when something happens, it usually feels extra shocking. In other words, just because it's labeled as safe, it doesn't mean bad things don't happen. And that's what we're talking about today, the case of Lauren Patterson, who moved from Kent, England, all the way to Qatar, in search of a different life. She was a teacher who found herself in a foreign land, embracing a new culture. Little did she know, though, that her path would cross with a man who would take everything away from her. With all that said, let's begin. Lauren was born on September 1st, 1989. To parents Stuart and Allison. She had a sister, Georgia, who was 8 years younger than her, and a brother, David, who was 10 years younger. The Pattersons were a well-off family in the early years of Lauren's life, but when she turned 18, an accident on a staircase would claim her father's life, leaving the rest of the family to fend for themselves. David and Georgia were far too young and couldn't comprehend what was happening. But Lauren was old enough to understand, so she stepped in to help the family get through this while her mother, Allison, grieved. Given the urgency of the situation, Lauren knew there was no room to mess around in her college days, so she quickly completed her teaching degree and started searching for an overseas job as a teacher that would pay her well enough to support her family. Her mother wasn't completely comfortable with her daughter, who had never been outside of England at that point, leaving for a place with a totally different culture. But Lauren was adamant she needed to do this, not just for herself, but for her family. The offer from Qatar was too good to pass up, and it would set her family up comfortably, which was her main priority. So by 2011, Lauren was working as an English teacher at the Newton British School in Doha, and she was loved by her students as she was everything you could want from a teacher: caring, patient, warm, and curious. Before she knew it, though, 2 years had passed, and everything was going well for Lauren and her family. Lauren had a boyfriend, James Grima, an IT tech and DJ living in Malta. Yes, it was a long-distance relationship. She was enjoying her new life in Doha and was in regular contact with her family back home. By this time, her mother had remarried and was living in bliss with her new husband, Kevin Crotty, with, of course, her siblings, David and Georgia. Lauren had made a quaint little life for herself in the busy and bustling city of Doha. She started earning on the side by giving private tutoring in English and was preparing for a master's degree as well. In a way, she kind of fits the description of an overseas foreign worker, except working as a teacher. As mentioned, her main goal was to find a job that could provide her with decent pay so she could help with her family back home. I also understand that it's not an apples-to-apples comparison, as I'm sure working as a teacher comes with more freedom, respect, and opportunities than, say, a domestic helper or a construction worker. You might recall episode 91, where we discuss various cases involving overseas foreign workers. It's not fair, but it's the unfortunate truth. But even in all her happiness, in this close-to-perfect world she had made for herself, one thing did bother Lauren. Whenever she would go back to her family for the holidays, she noticed that migrants and immigrants were not treated with much respect at the Doha airport. This, of course, circles back to what I just said about OFWs. Migrant workers from South or Southeast Asia are just not treated the same. It's like they're seen as a lower class. Those that were poorly treated were usually from countries like Pakistan, India, Bangladesh, or the Philippines. They were too frequently arrested by airport security, and this bothered her because, technically, she was also like them. Maybe she looked different from the others, but she was still one of them. I know many of us are aware that racism can be overt or subtle. For one thing, many migrant workers tend to come from less developed countries. These migrant workers are not hired to work in corporate offices or high-sitting positions in companies. They're usually hired to do more manual labor type jobs that locals do not want to do. These migrant workers are poorer. They're at a disadvantage since they're in a foreign land, and they do the type of work that no one else wants. In other words, it's easy to exploit them, expose them to harsh work environments, and give them as little as possible. It doesn't matter the reasoning behind them wanting to be a migrant worker. Even if they are hardworking and they don't commit crimes, there will always be extra set of eyes on them, waiting to catch them doing something deemed as wrong. It's kind of crazy to think that migrant workers make up most of the population in Qatar, and yet they're easily discriminated against. Take, for example, the World Cup 2022 in Qatar. Migrant workers were the pillar to getting everything built and set up, and in the end, an estimated amount of 500 migrant workers died as a result. Not sure if that's even an accurate number, as some other sources have a higher number. Now let's get back to Lauren. She mentioned this concern to her mother as well, and then in September of 2013, She got to experience this treatment firsthand. Her grandmother was on her deathbed, and Lauren was trying desperately to fly back to Kent to see her, but for whatever reason, the Qatari officials refused to stamp an exit visa on her passport, which would allow her to return after her trip. This obviously put her in a very difficult situation. On one hand, yes, you want to return home, but without this visa, she would have a lot of trouble returning to the life she built in Qatar. Sure, she could just say, fuck it, and leave it all behind, but it's never an easy choice. Although she was denied her exit visa, she did attempt to go through various other methods to find ways to make it happen. She didn't just give up, but when she finally received the visa she needed, her grandmother had already passed away. But she managed to make it in time to attend the funeral and be with her family during their time of grief. On Friday, October 11, 2013, Lauren left to return to Doha, and her mother asked her to text as soon as she landed. But they were both unaware of the fact that this would be their last meeting in communication, ever. They both expected to resume their lives after an already tragic event, but another one was about to hit the family soon after. The next day, Lauren should have already arrived at Doha, but there was no text to her mother. Even accounting for the time difference and flight duration, a message should surely have arrived by now. Lauren was, as we've seen, a responsible adult, and she would stay in regular contact with Allison. So when there was no message of her reaching Doha safely, panic started to set in. Allison contacted Lauren's friends in Doha to ask if she had met any one of them. Her friends went to her apartment to check up on her, but she was nowhere to be found. But she had clearly been home at some point because all of her luggage was on her bed. So Lauren did land in Doha. She did get home. She dropped her luggage off. And then what? Why would she leave without a message? Where did she go? Did she just forget, or did something urgent come up and she forgot to let her mother know? More friends were contacted, and those friends did their own search as well. And then it was discovered that Lauren had gone off to a hotel club with another friend, Leah Bonnet. And who was Leah? Leah is a 22-year-old French woman and friend of Lauren's, also living in Doha. And the two were close and often went out partying together. They were young women, so of course, having fun is a must. This hotel was popular among international students, and Lauren would go there often with friends to a club called Club 7. Once someone managed to contact Leah, she informed them of what she knew. On Friday evening, when Lauren arrived at the Doha airport, Leah had gone to pick her up. Then the two decided to go to Club 7 to have some fun. Leah drove Lauren back to her apartment to drop her stuff off, and she got changed and off they went. During their time at the club, a group of men had continuously tried to hit on them, offering them drinks and getting all touchy-feely. Gross club behavior. Turns out, these men were not complete strangers to Lauren and Leah. They were often spotted in the club and they knew of each other, but they were not like friends or anything. If you frequent an establishment often enough, it's not uncommon to find others like you, where you recognize the person and perhaps greet each other in passing. Nothing more than casual acquaintances. At around 1 a.m., the two women decided to call it a night, and when they decided to go grab a taxi, two of the men they vaguely knew approached them. They insisted that they would give them a ride home instead, and that it was fine. After some back and forth, both women agreed and got in the car with these two men that they kind of knew, but not really. Leah was dropped off first, and as she was getting out, Lauren assured her that she would be fine. So Lauren left with these two men, who again assured her that they would drop her off safely. One of the two men even texted Leah after a few hours, saying that Lauren had arrived home, but she had never returned home. No one heard from her again, not her family, not her friends. And understandably, this is where everyone started panicking. It was almost certain that something horrible had happened to Lauren, and Allison wasn't even in the same country, so there was nothing she could do. Allison's husband, Kevin, did the only thing they could think of and contacted the British Embassy in Qatar to report this, and the diplomats assured him that they would initiate a search for her. Meanwhile, Allison requested that Leah contact the local police and file a missing persons report for Lorne. Leah did just that and gave whatever information she had on the two men who were last seen with Lorne. Their names were, and I'm sorry I will mispronounce these names, Badr Hashim Khamis Abdallah Al-Jabbar and Muhammad Abdullah Hassan Abdal Aziz. Very long names, so please allow me to shorten them to make it easier for us. Al-Jabbar and Aziz. And who the hell are these two guys? Al-Jabbar worked as an airport police officer, while Aziz was unemployed at the time. Armed with that knowledge and not much else, the police started their investigation into the lives of these two men, as they became the prime suspects in this case. On a completely different side of the story, but absolutely related, there were two hunters trying to train their falcons in a desert miles away from the city of Doha. When these falcons did not return for a long time, the two hunters became suspicious and alarmed, so they left to search for them. This was when they noticed that both of the falcons were near a part of the desert that seemed to be on fire. When they got closer to the area, they realized it was a dead body in a pit, burning, as if somebody had tried cremating it. The men contacted the police, and that area of the desert was closed off. Several checkpoints were placed around the area in the hopes that the person responsible would return to the crime scene to make sure that the body was burnt beyond recognition. And that is exactly what happened. Criminals returning to the scene of the crime, whether for sick satisfaction or out of worry, is not uncommon. So thankfully, those two men were complete idiots, which made arresting them a lot easier. Both Al-Jabbar and Aziz returned to the desert to check on the body and were promptly captured by the police. A quick search of their car also revealed blood spatters on the seat, blood belonging to Lauren, as it turns out. Bear in mind that the remains were very charred, with most of her body burnt to ashes. But the police told Allison one major detail. The victim seemed to be wearing red nail polish. Maybe it could have been anyone, but Allison knew it was her. Because when Lauren left for Doha on October 11th, she was wearing red nail polish. Allison, of course, was devastated, but she had to be there for her daughter. She was on the next flight out of London to identify the body, and without a doubt, the body belonged to Lauren. The trial of this case began in January of 2014, and both Al-Jabbar and Aziz were charged with the murder of Lauren Patterson. Many could guess what went down that night, but several disturbing details came up at the trial. Turns out, after dropping Leah off, Al-Jabbar decided that he wanted to take Lauren to his home. She rejected his advances, and as we know, some people are very entitled and don't like taking no for an answer. So he decided that he had to forcefully take her to his house, where he then brutally raped her. He then used an 8-inch knife to stab her repeatedly, killing her in the most horrific manner. The knife was also thrown into the fire pit, but of course, it did not burn and was identified. The resulting scene ended up scaring him, though. So to avoid confronting his own actions, he called his buddy Aziz back to help him put her body in his car and drive it to the desert. The way this information is presented seems that Aziz was also dropped off after Leah left, or perhaps he left separately, and only Al-Jabbar was responsible for driving the two women. Either way, both ended up involved, but one more than the other. The sand dunes were miles away from the city, so they found a spot and started digging. Not to bury her, though. They filled this pit with charcoal that you might use for barbecues, and then they dumped Lauren's body into it. Once Lauren's body was just barely covered, they struck a match and lit everything on fire. They must have not expected anyone to connect the crime to them, but when they returned to the crime scene, it became a slam dunk. Also, let's not forget Leah knew that Lauren was in the car with at least one of them. It wouldn't be impossible to identify him either. In March of 2014, the Qatar lower court found Al-Jabbar guilty of the rape and murder of Lauren Patterson, and he was sentenced to death. The prosecution argued that, quote, because the defendant is Muslim, the Islamic Sharia principle of qasas, or retribution, should be exacted in the form of the death penalty, unquote. Which to me kind of sounds like eye for an eye. Although he did admit to raping Lauren, it was impossible for forensics to find proof of this as Lauren's body was already burned. Even if Lauren consented to sex with Al-Jabbar, he and Lauren were not married, and unmarried people having sexual intercourse is basically a crime. So regardless, he still needs to be heavily punished, and of course, let's not forget, he murdered her. His partner, Aziz, was sentenced to 3 years in prison for being an accomplice, despite the prosecution asking the court to give him the maximum sentence. He was released in 2016. Do you think that that was a fair sentence? During the years that followed, Al-Jabbar submitted multiple appeals to the court, requesting that his death sentence be reduced and his life be spared. Allison was, of course, completely against this, and she would make sure that she was present in each of these hearings to avoid that from happening. She traveled to Qatar more than 30 times in this period of her life, at her own expense, to make sure Al-Jabbar never saw the outside world again. It seems pretty reasonable, right? A man allegedly raped and killed a woman, and that should be a pretty heavy crime. Why would he get any sympathy, especially in a strict country like Qatar? Well, in November of 2018, the Qatar High Court of Cassation, the highest court in their judicial system, made a decision that would shake the community's belief in the justice system. The death sentence was changed, and the reason that was given by the court was that this case was not a first-degree murder, it was manslaughter, which meant that the murder was an accident and Al-Jabbar did not intend to kill Lauren. This came as a shock to everyone who was part of this case, because the details and evidence showed that he was calm and collected throughout the situation. He was of sound enough mind to plan where to dump the body and how to get rid of the evidence. The motives were clear as well, because he killed Lauren to make sure the rape was never reported. All of this pointed towards the fact that Al-Jabbar had every intention to kill her, and this could not be counted as an accident. How do you accidentally rape somebody and then stab them multiple times? But to everyone's disappointment, except Al-Jabbar and I guess his supporters, the court did believe it to be an accident. And so then his sentence was reduced to a 10.5-year imprisonment sentence. Wild. Death to 10 years. Not even life with or without the possibility of parole. Allison was also promised compensation of £200,000, which, as of the recording of this episode, she has still not received. Adding more to the struggles of the Patterson family, the legal fees and traveling expenses created a long-standing debt for Allison. All of this called into question a greater problem: how the life of an immigrant is much less valuable than that of a local Qatari man. You would think that a country that so heavily relies on expat and migrants would at least acknowledge their contribution. But in another sense, maybe because Qatari make up such a small percentage of the population, do they want to protect their citizens more, maybe? In a Facebook post, Allison wrote, quote, "I feel devastated that they think Lauren's death was nothing, as he is Qatari and above everyone else. They can hand out death sentences to non-Qataris and carry them out, so why not for Lauren? This justice system is an absolute farce. I will meet with the British ambassador and my lawyer later. I will be appealing this," unquote. After the verdict was changed in 2018, Al-Jabbar was set to be released after the FIFA World Cup in 2022, which was hosted in Qatar. So to combat that, Allison addressed 27 letters to either the Football Association or the bases of the players' respective league clubs. She requested them to think of Lauren when they ran to the pitch, writing, quote, "If just one of them made an L-shape after scoring a goal or winning a match, it would honor Lauren and mean so much," unquote. She included details of Lauren's death and how the Qatar justice system had failed her, all in the hopes of convincing the players to mention Lauren on the international forum they were all a part of. Receiving acknowledgement and attention from the World Cup would potentially have worked in stopping Al-Jabbar's release from prison. And so Allison tried everything to make this happen, She knew that this release meant that he would get a second chance at life, something that Lauren had been robbed of. It would mean that Lauren had lost. And as depressing as it may be, all her efforts went in vain because the courts upheld their decision to reduce the sentence. Al-Jabbar was released in 2023, back into society that failed Lauren so badly. So there you have it, the extremely sad and frustrating case of Lauren Patterson, a young woman who met her untimely death because some asshole thought he deserved whatever he wanted. This is a heartbreaking reminder of the fragility of life and the reality of this world. Many of us can be denied justice just because of where we come from. This case, though, brings a complete different angle to how we perceive race and ethnicity. It's very common to hear of white privilege and such, and to an extent, it is a real thing. But there are parts of the world where they are more determined to protect their own people. Although death penalties are legal in Qatar, they are actually rarely carried out. With the last execution taking place in May of 2020, and before that, in March of 2003. The man who was executed in 2020 was a Nepali man who killed a Qatari national. Not surprising, as it was a South Asian man who did the killing, and he was an employee at a car wash, so definitely not seen above their own people. Whether or not Qatar's justice system is biased, I cannot say with 100% certainty. But I am inclined to believe that there are flaws in every single system, in every single country, but maybe some more obvious than others. After all, these laws are created by man. And what are we? Just a bunch of flawed human beings. It's unfair, but it can serve as a bitter reminder that we only have ourselves to rely on for our own safety. Thank you all for taking the time to tune in to Lauren's case. Please be safe and trust your gut. Better safe than sorry. Till next time.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.